From the City of Angels, near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world, I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, Dr. Michael Sala joins us, Secret Space Program, and we talk about that internet sensation called Q. Here's what's happening. President Donald Trump said he expected a second summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un to be announced pretty soon, and the location had yet to be determined. Iran, on the other side, is warning attackers who killed 25 people at a military parade that they were paid by Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, and he says Iran would severely punish those behind the bloodshed. Let's find out what happens there. Dr. John Curtis, onlinecolumnist.com, with us here. What do you think he meant by that, John?
Well, I think, you know, they're at war. Iran with Saudi Arabia. We know this in a proxy war. They're, you know, shooting missiles from Yemen that are delivered by the Iranians in Yemen at the Saudi airport and close to Riyadh. So there's no love lost between the two countries right now. And these were separatists. These are Arab separatists living in Iran. They have groups over there that really would like to overthrow the Mullah government, partly because it's a Shiite regime. And as you know, the Saudis are Wahhabis, radical Sunnis, for the most part. So there's zero love between those two countries. But the fact that they target the U.S., death to Israel, death to the United States, George, is just the kind of rhetoric that somehow they think bolsters the Mullah regime over there, letting know that the chink in the armor with the massacre that took place at this military parade is the Mullah regime is still supreme and that they can do something about it. The truth is they're in horrific financial shape. They're in a very weakened military position because of spreading themselves so thin in Syria. And if they were to attack the United States or Israel, there would be devastating consequences. And I think the mullahs in Tehran know that they would lose their power.
You know, who do you think might have been responsible for the attack on that military parade?
They have groups that are living in Iran of Arabs that are separatists that are opposed to the mullah regime. And as I said, they would like to install a Wahhabi-style government in Iran. Of course, that'll never happen, but that's what they would like to do.
All right, my friend. John Curtis, onlinecolumnist.com is his website. When it comes to credit, Americans are scoring pretty good. For the first time, the average national credit score has reached 702, according to FICO. Developers are one of the most commonly used scores by lenders. Now, FICO scores range from 300 to 850. Drivers for online platforms, including Uber and Lyft, are making less than half of what they did 4 years ago, even as more and more people are drawn into working for them. A new report from J.P. Morgan Chase Institute, based on payments directed to 2.3 million families, showed that the average monthly platform earnings dropped considerably by 53% between 2013 and 2017. These drivers made $783 a month in 2017 versus $1,469 in 2013. An amazing story. Three patients, all paralyzed from the waist down, have been able to walk again after having an electrical patch fitted to their spinal cords. Experts say this device, which is placed below the injury, helps lost signals from the brain reach the leg muscles. That's amazing technology. I'm not a fan of mosquitoes, but researchers have used gene editing to completely eliminate populations of mosquitoes in a laboratory. The team tested their technique on the mosquito, which transmits malaria. What I'm opposed to here is the fact that they can genetically wipe out all kinds of things. That's dangerous. Tonight's full moon is a special name. It's called the Harvest Moon. It's the full moon closest to the northern autumn equinox. In years past, farmers depended on the light of the Harvest Moon to gather ripening crops late in the night. What else is going on in the skies? Let's check in with Stephen Cates, Dr. Sky. Hi, Stephen.
Hello there, George. We begin with space for all of our excited listeners out there. And just in case you didn't catch the skies, Mars Curiosity rover has had some mysterious glitch in its ability to send back data, George, back to the Earth. And this started last Saturday. So the scientists have decided to shut down all the science instrumentation to learn about the source and maybe use the backup computer. Some might speculate that a dust storm-related incident is going on here, but conspiracy theories rule, of course. Also in space, George, another great spacecraft. We didn't hear much about this until about a week ago. Japan's Hayabusa 2 spacecraft just launched two small rovers onto this tiny asteroid known as Ryugu. What is it? It's a one-kilometer-sized asteroid with gravity. Get a load of this, George. The surface gravity, which means it's difficult for these little rovers to stay on the surface, is only 1/80,000th of that of the Earth. So if you and I were standing on it, if we jumped up, we might just totally move on to space. Ryugu in Japan means the Dragon Palace. This asteroid was discovered back in 1999 in New Mexico. But George, in the live sky, as you alluded to before, sky watchers all over the nation, around the world, the beautiful harvest moon tops the news in the live sky right now. Just a fascinating moon with so much law and history behind it. This particular bright moon obviously will continue to rise, George. If you look, folks, look on Tuesday evening, it'll be rising just about the same time it did because obviously the light of the moon, plus the harvest moon, was used to help, of course, farmers harvest crops. Finally, Mars is in the news. If you look into the southeast sky, George, and the listeners, Mars is still fantastic in a telescope. Look now, because it's moving, of course, away from the Earth. The southern polar cap is visible. And on the 16th of October, we begin winter in the northern hemisphere on Mars and summer in the southern hemisphere. As always, the understatement of the century, always remember to keep your eyes to the skies and email me often at drsky@cox.net.
Thank you, Stephen. Always great talking to you. In a moment, two former Navy SEALs join us. They're best-selling authors. Their first book, Extreme Ownership, the latest, The Dichotomy of Leadership. They will join us to talk about that, The Dichotomy of Leadership, next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. I'm going to introduce you to two retired U.S. Navy SEALs. The first is Jocko Willink. He's a retired U.S. Navy SEAL officer, co-founder of Echelon Front, where he serves as the CEO, leadership instructor, speaker, strategic advisor to highly successful companies and organizations. Jocko spent 20 years in the SEAL teams, rising from the ranks to become a SEAL officer, became the most highly decorated special operations unit of the Iraq War. Jocko returned from Iraq and became officer in charge of training for all West Coast SEAL teams. Let's say hello to Jocko first of all. Hello there, Jocko. Welcome to the show.
George, thanks for having me on.
I'm looking forward to this. And let us bring in Leif Babin, a former U.S. Navy SEAL. He's your partner, co-founder of Echelon Front as well. He serves as president and chief operating officer. He, too, is a leadership instructor, speaker, strategic advisor to companies and business leaders, a graduate of the U.S. Naval Academy. He served 13 years in the Navy, including 9 in the SEALs teams, including time as a platoon commander, one of the most highly decorated special operations unit of the Iraq War. Leif, welcome to the show, too.
Thanks for having us.
I want to thank you both for serving. I served 9 years in the Navy. My unit had got called up to Desert Storm with General Schwarzkopf. We were public information officers, and I had retired or got out of it a month before the Iraq War. It's amazing. But thank you for what you both do.
Appreciate your service.
So let us talk about the first book for just a little bit, because that will set the stage for the dichotomy of leadership. And let's start with you, Leif, if we can. Extreme Ownership. Tell us about that.
Well, Jocko and I launched we launched our leadership company about 7 years ago now. And as we worked with a number of companies, they would ask us, hey, can you write down your leadership principles? Can you give us something to reference, you know, when you're not here working with us? And so the demand signal grew and grew and grew, and finally we put that down, and that became the book that we call Extreme Ownership. So that was the principles that we learned on the battlefield, this idea that leaders have to own everything in their world. There's no one to blame. There's no excuses. And you got to own not just what you're responsible for, but everything that impacts your mission. And that's what we titled the book, because that's really the foundational principle upon which everything else is based. We talk about the four laws of combat in that book. govern, move, simple, prioritize, and execute, decentralized command. Those four laws of combat are how a team works together, and those are lessons we brought back from the battlefield that apply directly to any team in any organization.
Well, that's what's so important. This is not a book. The Dichotomy of Leadership, for example, is not a book about just the Iraq War, but it's about leadership and what you two went through in that war and what they're probably still going through right now. That you can apply to just about everything in your day-to-day living, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. This is Jocko, and certainly we found that as we started working with civilian companies that the leadership principles that we used on the battlefield were leadership principles that applied in any situation, and then as we saw it unfold into the civilian sector completely, we saw that people utilize these skills to help with their personal lives, to help with their marriage, to help with their relationships with their kids and how they interact with their kids' schools or other organizations that they're involved in. So, yeah, they're really universal principles.
Unlike Vietnam, Jocko, where sadly when the soldiers came back, they were not yielded as heroes and as patriots, but they were looked down upon by so many people, and that was the biggest mistake I think I've ever seen. And, you know, I was in my early 20s when that was happening. When you came back from Iraq, did you feel as if the American public supported you as a military person? Not necessarily the war. I've got my issues with that. But, I mean, as a soldier, did you get the kind of respect you deserved?
Yeah, I would say we definitely got well-respected and well-treated when we came home from the war. And I think that we learned our lessons as a nation after Vietnam to make sure that our veterans, when they come home from war, regardless of how someone might feel about the war itself, that they treat our soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines with respect for doing their job and doing their part in trying to protect freedom.
Leif, let's talk a little bit about leadership today, and whether it's the corporate world or politics. How do you think it's going?
Well, I think we see good leaders and we see bad leaders. And, you know, the biggest thing that leaders need to exhibit is humility. And there's that quality of humility allows leaders to look in the mirror, take this brutally honest self-assessment and recognize where they can get better, recognize where their team is maybe not accomplishing their mission, where they can improve. And, frankly, we work with amazing leaders across about every industry that you can imagine, incredible leaders and stuff, men and women that are stepping up, that are leading their teams. And I'd say we've got pretty strong leadership.
Isn't a good leader someone who's not afraid to admit they made a mistake sometimes?
That's exactly it. That's exactly it. Because guess who never makes mistakes? Nobody. Everyone's going to make mistakes. So this idea that like you can't admit that you made a mistake, it's ridiculous. Everyone already knows that you're going to screw up from time to time. So the reason that extreme ownership was so important is that that concept really resonated with so many people. Is that if you don't admit your mistakes, you're never going to actually take a look at those mistakes, figure out a problem figure out a solution to the problem, so those problems continue to happen over and over and over again. So, and of course, then you never get better as a result. So that's really that's why humility is so important. That's why extreme ownership is so important. And really, then the bigger issue we see with leadership, that's why we wrote the second book, The Dichotomy of Leadership, is because it's one of the most common problems we see with leaders is this idea that, they hear a word like extreme in the title there and misinterpret that to think they got to be on the extreme end of one side or the other, of these two forces pulling on them. And really what leaders need is balance. You got to find balance somewhere in the middle between two opposing forces. So you got to be a leader and you got to be a follower.
Well, and Teddy Roosevelt once said, if you have never made a mistake, that means you've never tried at anything.
That's exactly right.
So right. How close, Jocko, should a company leader, a military leader, get to their rank and file or the troops? Like I've heard so many different things that they should not be friendly with the people that they work with or who work under them. And then I've heard other people say it creates a family atmosphere if they know them well. So where do you stand?
George, that's a great question, and that actually comes directly from something that we talk about inside the dichotomy of leadership, because that is one of those dichotomies that absolutely has to be balanced. And the fact of the matter is, can a leader be too close to their troops where they start to make decisions based on their personal relationships instead of based on what's best for the mission? Yes, that can absolutely happen. Can a leader be too distant from their troops where they don't know them well enough to understand what's driving them, what's motivating them, and they don't understand what's happening in their personal lives and what kind of decisions they could make to help the person have a better life overall? Yes, they can be too distant. So what a leader has to do is they have to constantly modulate between being too close and being too far away from their people. And the other thing that's tricky, especially with that dichotomy, is there's different people that can handle it differently. So I might have one subordinate leader or subordinate person on my team that I can be very, very close to, but when, you know, we can go out, we can go out and have some dinner, we can hang out on the weekends, but when we get to work, he knows it's professional.
Mm-hmm.
He goes back into that mode of me being the boss and him, you know, following what I say, or at least doing what we're trying to make happen. On the other hand, I might have someone that I go out to dinner with one time or hang out with over the weekend. All of a sudden, he thinks we're best friends and he doesn't need to listen to me at work anymore. So what I have to do is I have to find the balance in between those two. It's a little bit different for each person. I would tell you this, when you work with someone, you lean towards being a little bit more distant at the beginning because it's harder to take that slack back out and try and separate yourself than it is to continue to get closer to someone over time in a controlled manner so that trust and that relationship doesn't get violated.
I know in our case here at Coast to Coast, I've got a handful of people that I work with that I have for the last 16 years, minimal turnover. And I let them do their thing. I'll step in when I think I have to, but by and large, they're professionals. They know what they're doing in all capacities. But they know that if I say something, that's the way it is. And they have that kind of respect, and I have that kind of respect for them.
Yeah, and that makes sense. And I'll tell you, if you have a good relationship with your people, and I'll put you on the spot now, George, if one of your people, if you said, hey, this is the way we're going to do it, and one of your people that has a lot of experience says, hey, George, I think this might be a better way, and here's why, a good leader, a good boss is going to say, you know what, your idea makes sense, let's go with that, and there's no ego getting involved.
Exactly.
What you try and do as a team is come up with the best plan, not worry about who actually came up with a plan and who's going to get credit. It's all about what's best for the team.
Yeah, I want my staffers to challenge me. I don't want to surround myself with a bunch of yes people.
That's 100% right, and I advise leaders to set themselves up in that way all the time. You don't want to be surrounded by yes men. You don't want to be in an echo chamber. The best ideas are not formulated inside of an echo chamber. That doesn't work out.
When we talk about some of the things that you two went through in Iraq, and just reading the dichotomy of leadership, I mean, you went through a lot of things where, you know, you are almost ambushed. When you noticed, for example, that the citizens of Ramadi started disappearing, you knew there was going to be an imminent attack, that it was going to come upon you. What's it like to be in that kind of situation, knowing that at any moment, from any building, you could get killed?
Well, the urban environment is incredibly difficult to fight in, and we certainly found that out, you know, day in, day out operations where, you know, we're fighting against an insurgency that hit amongst the civilian populace. It was hard to determine, you know, who the bad guys were. And you'd have folks that would come out and dump 100 rounds from a belt-fed machine gun at you and then ditch their weapon and then walk down the street as if they're an average citizen and you can't shoot them because they're unarmed. So those were incredibly difficult. We had an aggressive posture as we moved into those areas. We tried to mitigate risk by setting up sniper overwatch teams that could protect our guys on the ground. But frankly, I think the best way we could describe those operations, George, was awesome. We had a lot of fun in there, and we had some tough fights, and we had some tough days where we lost guys. And I'd trade those days for anything, but most of those days were some of the best days of my life. We knew we were fighting an evil insurgency. We knew we were delivering impact on the battlefield, and we learned tremendous leadership lessons learned, you know, from those efforts.
Did you ever feel, why are we here? Did that ever hit you?
Hey, this is Jocko again, and Actually, no. I never had the feeling of why are we here. And especially when you're on the ground in these situations, what was amazing about Ramadi and what was amazing about my deployment or our deployment to Ramadi was that we worked in that one city the whole time we were there. So we saw the citizens of Ramadi. We saw what they were going through. And we got to see their reactions when we were in the city, when we were fighting against the insurgents. They were definitely scared of the insurgents, but they were the local citizens of Ramadi were in full support of us being there. They wanted the insurgents ousted from their city, and they were joyous that we were there on the ground helping them.
We're going to take a quick break, but we'll be back with both of you as we talk about the dichotomy of leadership next on Coast to Coast AM. Hard to believe we're into autumn already. Whoa, what a fast year indeed. We're going to take your phone calls next hour with Jocko and Leif as we talk about the work, the dichotomy of leadership. So get ready to make the calls. And welcome back to Coast, our two special guests with us, Jocko Willink and Leif Babin, as we talk about their work, the dichotomy of leadership, both former Navy SEALs. They put their life on the line for you, and they're here with us talking about what they do now, and that's heading up a company called Echelon Front. Where'd you get that name, Jocko?
We got that name from the fact that during the Vietnam War, which we talked about earlier, a very commonly used term was talking about the rear echelon people, the leaders that were in the rear, back with the gear in the headquarters, and they weren't out on the front lines. And the frontline troops had a very derogatory name for them, and they called them the rear echelon, and there were some other additional words, which I won't say on the air, but they called them the rear echelon folks. And so we wanted to make sure that people knew that we were talking about leadership on the front line, and that's why we called the name Echelon Front. We were the leaders that were on the front line, and we wanted people to know that.
Leif, I like the way in the book how both of you wrote various chapters, and you put your names on the chapters so we know who wrote what. But you could tell you two have been partners for a while. You guys flow together.
Well, I appreciate that. We certainly have worked together for a long time. Jocko and I started working together in the spring of 2005. He was my immediate boss as the task unit commander, the overall commander of Task Unit Bruiser, which is two 60-man SEAL platoons and a 5-man headquarters element. And I was one of his two platoon commanders, commander of Charlie Platoon. So it was 16 SEALs. So we worked together. Jocko was the really trained and mentored me and taught me to be the combat leader I needed to be, and then unleashed me on the battlefield, with my guys to go make a difference there.
Let's start with you, Leif. If you could relate to us a story in Vietnam, in Iraq rather, that really is something you'll never forget.
Well, there's all kinds of stories I could tell you that I'll never forget. I mean, I think. For us, one of the big wake up calls, a lot of us that had deployed to Iraq previously. So in my 16-man SEAL platoon, I had five new guys who'd never been overseas, who were straight out of training, and many of us previously though had been to Iraq before on previous deployments. So we thought we had some combat experience. But when we showed up to Ramadi, the very first day that the task unit arrived, there was a huge attack on the camp. And we were getting shot at, and so basically the whole task unit ran up to the rooftop as bullets were flying and hitting the stairwell, and we had our entire task unit sitting on the rooftop, shooting across the river at insurgents that were shooting back at us, and shooting at a nearby Army security checkpoint. So it was, guys were shooting their machine guns, 40-millimeter grenades, everything in the world. Basically, a ridiculous amount of fire was being unleashed across the river at those insurgents, and we were all kind of looking around thinking, man, this is the first time we've ever had a major attack on the camp. And several guys who deployed, this is their second or third time to Iraq, had never even fired their belt-fed machine guns before. So we knew it was going to be a very, very different deployment for us. And that was something that really, I certainly won't forget, that stands out in my mind.
How about you, Jocko?
Well, for me, obviously, my whole life had been in the SEAL teams at that point, my whole adult life, and I had deployed to Iraq before as a platoon commander and had done, a multitude of operations, mostly what we called direct action missions, where we'd go out in the middle of the night and we would know the location of a terrorist or some other enemy personnel, and we'd conduct an operation, a direct action operation, to grab that person and bring them back to base. We'd interrogate them. We'd find out where their friends were, and then we'd go get their friends. Those missions were relatively quick, and, you know, they take a couple hours usually, and we'd come back to base, and we kind of high-five and feel pretty good about it. We had a pretty good tactical advantage over the enemy at that time. But when we got back, when we got to Ramadi in the spring of 2006, it was really a whole different type of war. And as soon as we got there, I realized that this was a completely different situation. We were going to memorial services for Army soldiers and U.S. Marines almost within the first few days that we were there. There was guys getting wounded and killed on a daily basis. And I remember, you know, sometimes as the commander, I had multiple different elements. The platoons were broken up into different elements, and sometimes I would go out in the field with them. Sometimes I would not. One thing that I'll never forget is just one of those nights, one of those early nights, and Leif's platoon, as a matter of fact, it was Leif's platoon, was lined up in the Humvees. They were getting ready to roll out into the city. And again, we were probably just a week or two into deployment. And we had driven by this one area of Ramadi, one area of Camp Ramadi, where all the vehicles that had been blown up by the enemy were dragged back to base, and they were lined up, probably 75 to 100 vehicles that had been destroyed, and significant amount of casualties had taken place from those roadside bombs. And we would drive by those every day. So as I'm standing there one night early in deployment, I'm watching my guys getting ready to roll out into that city. And I looked at the lead turret gunner, so the guy in the Humvee, the first Humvee, standing up in the turret on the heavy machine gun. It was a guy by the name of Mark Lee. And I just remember thinking to myself, here's this kid, 25, 26 years old, young, brave, and he's so exposed to the enemy, and he is willing, and he is ready, and he is going to roll out into that city night after night to do his duty. And I'll never forget what that was like for me to see my friends, my brothers, my men roll out every night and willing to risk their lives to help the people inside the city of Ramadi.
Did we as a nation, besides not attacking you folks as they did in Vietnam, but did we do anything to support the troops when they came back from Iraq?
I think we've had a ton of support for troops to come back. Now, look, you can always do more, certainly, and I think anyone could see over the last few years that we've got some massive problems at the VA. They're getting better, but it's still a giant government bureaucracy that struggles. But I think there's a massive reception to veterans coming back, and there's new organizations being formed all the time, and there's been tremendous private charity organizations that have reached out to help guys, I think we've done pretty well as a nation, and of course we can always do better. So I think there's a lot of good hardworking folks that see the need for that, and are launching organizations every week. There's something new coming out that is available, or they're enhancing current programs.
Why do so many troops come back with PTSD?
Well, this is Jocko again, and what happens is you're going into a very traumatic situation. You're going to see things that most people aren't going to see in their lifetime. You're going to see a significant amount of human suffering, and you're going to see your friends, your comrades, your brothers in arms, and your sisters in arms. In some cases, you're going to see them either severely wounded, you're going to see them killed, and that's a hard thing for a young person to process.
Sure.
And I think clearly that's what the issue is, and it doesn't happen to everyone, and different people handle it in different ways. And the best thing that we can do as a nation is try and give them the support we need and give them the help that they need.
I wonder if there's any way of screening the military soldiers before they go in the battle to prevent that. Is there?
I don't know that there would be a way to screen it, because I think it's hard to detect what kind of person is going to handle that kind of stress which way without them actually undergoing the stress. But I think more important than the screening, I mean, screening would be great, but I think more important than that is recognizing the signs, recognizing when someone needs a break from that kind of stress, and getting them the help once they've start to show some of those signs.
You both mentioned earlier that one of the true aspects of leadership is humility. And without this seeming political, because we try to stay very non-political in this program, but I don't see humility coming out of this leadership in this administration. Do you?
Well, that's...
I'm going to put you on the spot.
No, no problem. I would say that, you know, the leadership that we're seeing right now certainly does not show that the same type of humility that we would want to see from a leader. This is something that needs to be modulated, just like any other of the dichotomies of leadership. As a matter of fact, ego is one of the dichotomies of leadership, and that is, you, in order to be a leader, you have to have some level of ego. You have to have some, you know, a pretty high level of confidence that you believe in what you're doing and that you believe you can make things happen. In order to be a good leader, you have to do that. Now, can you go too far with that, where you think you can accomplish everything and you think you know it better than everyone else? Yes, you can. On the other side of the spectrum, you could have a leader that doesn't have confidence and that doesn't really believe in what they're doing and doesn't believe that they can make things happen. And what we look for in a leader is a leader that finds the balance somewhere in the middle. They're not overconfident, but they're not worried that they can actually make things happen. And, yeah, I would say that we see in politics, in our political leadership, sometimes we see people that don't have enough confidence. Sometimes we see people that have a little bit too much ego. I would say it's a safe statement to say that right now we usually see leadership that leans towards having too much ego.
Well, you have leadership right now that just uses the word I too much.
Well, I think it's a mistake for any leader to focus on themselves all the time, and definitely any good leader will talk about not what I do as an individual, but what we do as a team.
Can somebody change, you know, why, let's say they read that dichotomy of leadership, are they going to change overnight, or is it difficult for them to change?
Look, I think change is always difficult, but the reality is all that's required to get better is just the willingness to be able to check your ego enough to have that realistic self-assessment. And that's all it takes. If you're willing to take a look at yourself and say, okay, where can we do better? Where did I not do as good as I could have? Where are we weak? Where as a team do we need to improve? Where are we actually accomplishing the mission? Where are we not? I think that's all that's actually required to improve as a leader. I think that's we've seen leaders. When I was running the leadership course for all the junior officers that were graduating from our SEAL basic training pipeline that were eventually would be out in the serving in the teams as SEAL officers, we would see guys who even struggled initially and weren't great leaders, but if they were willing to listen and they were willing to learn and they're willing to accept some constructive criticism, they actually became very effective leaders over time. And others who maybe had a little more innate qualities of charisma or things like that, initially they struggled and they didn't get better if they couldn't listen. So that's all that's required.
I'm assuming through Echelon Front, you two are brought in to speak before groups at companies. Is that pretty accurate guess?
Absolutely.
When you do that, what are they looking for? What do they want? Those who bring you in.
It depends on the company and it depends on the situation. We work with all different kinds of companies. And when we go and speak, the bulk of our job is actually going in and spending some amount of time within the company to find out what makes them tick, what issues that they're having. Now, here's an interesting
point.
You're
like those two guys in Office Space.
Yes. What are they, the two Bobs?
Yeah, that's right.
So
what do you do, Bob?
Yeah, when we go into an organization, sometimes we get brought in, or most of the time, I should say, we get brought in by the organization itself. We've got someone in there that knows that they need to work on their leadership. They know that leadership is the key to success in any organization. So they bring us in, they have a great open mind, and they want to learn, and that's great. Sometimes, though, we do get brought in by, let's say, the board of a company will bring us in because the CEO or the leadership inside the company needs help. And interestingly, those are the companies, of course, they have the worst attitude, and they're doing poorly. And one of the main reasons why they're doing poorly is because they don't think they have any problems. And so the market, you know, they blame the problems that the company is having on the market, or they blame that the competitor did something they didn't expect. Instead of saying, hey, it's not the market, it's not the competitor, it's me, it's my leadership, and this is what I'm going to do to change it, when we come in and work with those companies, they say, oh, we don't really need help, and those are the ones that are having the problems. And the reason they're having the problems, as Leif just pointed out, is because they lack humility and they're blaming everyone else.
I'm amazed, too, at how the founders of some companies are ultimately kicked out of the company that they started by their board of directors for some atrocity or something happens. What's that all about?
Well, what what that's all about is some, you know, different people have different skills in life. And sometimes someone comes up with a great idea, and they're a great idea person, and they come up with a great idea, and they found a company, and that company starts to grow. And as that company grows, all of a sudden, the skill that they need isn't technical. The skill that they need isn't intelligence. The skill that they need is actually leadership. And if they don't transform and become a leader and realize that that's the area that they need to focus on, yeah, they end up in a situation where they're in over their heads, and the board comes in and says, look, thanks for founding the company. Thanks for this great idea, but we need someone that can lead now. And we love to catch companies in that transition while that leader is transforming into a much, much better leader.
Mm-hmm.
Occasionally, though, we get brought in too late, and the founder of a company, let's say, is already gone. But that's generally why it happens. People, you know, leadership is a skill that you have to learn, you have to work on, and it just doesn't come naturally to people. And if they don't make that transition and they don't learn about leadership, they have trouble running the company, and it becomes problematic.
Wouldn't that great founder be smart to find his own deficiency and say, I'm going to find someone who can run this business while I create and do what I do?
That's absolutely right. And like I just said, different people have different talents. And if you're a person that is a visionary, that has a great imagination and has that creative spark to you, and you can come up with great ideas, that's super. Generally, that person is going to need someone to help them out actually run and lead the business. So when that happens, and someone's smart enough and humble enough, because that's the other problem. Sometimes these folks that are founders, they don't have the humility to say, oh, you know what? I'm a visionary, but I'm not the best leader. Let me turn this over, or let me improve my leadership skills. That works out. But when they decide they're going to hang on to it because their ego is too big, that's when it becomes problematic.
Yeah, the late Steve Jobs, who founded Apple Computer with Steve Wozniak, was booted out of his company a long time ago, and then they brought him back again because technology kept changing and they needed that creativity. But they had problems with him as a leader, too.
Yeah, and that's one question that people will ask me from time to time is, well, you know, Steve Jobs, he was sort of a tyrannical leader, and things seemed to work out great for him. And I always say to people, well, listen, if you think, I mean, here's what Steve Jobs had. He had this incredible intellect. He had this incredible creativity. He had an incredible sense of design. He had an incredible sense for what the consumer wanted. He had all those things at such a high level that they kind of overcame the fact that his leadership was left a little bit to be desired. And if he would have had that leadership element as well, he probably never would have been kicked out of company, and he would have been able to maintain that position. But, you know, he came back, and he did surround himself with some people that had a little bit better leadership than he did, better at interacting with people, that was able to keep the company moving forward.
Are kids spending too much time on social media these days?
Well, absolutely. Yeah, I have.
Understatement.
I have four children, three of whom are teenagers, and you know, I don't think my kids spend an inordinate amount of time on the social media or on the internet in general. But I definitely see it amongst their friends. There's definitely kids that are completely absorbed in that. And, you know, social media it's a double-edged sword, just like anything else. There's a dichotomy to social media. I mean, with social media, you can get connected with people around the whole world that might have similar interests to you, and that's a very positive thing. However, the double-edged sword is that you can also get to a point where you're comparing yourself to everyone else in the world, and you're comparing yourself to the absolute best vision that everyone has of themselves, because they don't post pictures of themselves when they don't look perfect. They post pictures of themselves when they look great and in a great situation. And so people start to compare themselves, and they can feel like maybe they're not doing as well as everyone else, and that can lead them down a downward spiral.
Good point. Jocko, we're going to come back in Leif as well. We're going to take phone calls with both of you. The name of the book, The Dichotomy of Leadership, their websites are linked up at coasttocoastam.com.